Colonel Desmond White, plead real three.
We had managed to get in four 25-pounders by now, and they dropped their shells where they believed the Japanese were, mostly at night. The enemy still were letting us alone. The Dakotas were coming in, loaded, and we managed to get two anti-aircraft guns in, because the enemy planes the next day came over, 15 planes came over, and dropped a much unwanted load in it around us with quite heavy casualties. Then silence again. Then the thing that we had worried about. We heard the Japanese 100 and 150 millimeter guns. We began to realize they were ranging on our position. We'd already let the Royal Air Force know where we thought the guns might be, and the American contingent, air contingent commandos, and they came over and carried out recces to try to find them. They didn't seem to be very successful, and the enemy began to plaster us, sitting target, with heavy shells. We weren't in a position to be able to go out with patrol parties to destroy the guns. We hadn't sufficient people left, and those that were left were quite incapable of making any sort of journey. The shelling was quite disastrous because men were being buried alive. I and my doctors, I had six doctors with me because the whole brigade was there. We found ourselves in a terribly difficult position. A lot of surgery in the mud. Monsoon had broken. It was May. Heavy rain. And when a shower came, at least a thunderstorm, the lightning would come down on you, and the thunder seemed to come from under the ground. I mean, it lifted the ground. Mules stampeding. Very little to eat. Death and misery everywhere. Smell. Of course, the bodies on the wire, not improving things. The enemy had now turned his AK guns on the Dakotas. Some of them were damaged. I didn't actually see any crashing from where we were, but they flew off, never to appear again. We were on our own. We were trapped. We were like rats in a trap because there was no way out. We knew the end couldn't be far off. The enemy had now learnt his lesson. He came in from the south. A creeping barrage of shelling came right across us. We knew what it meant. Those of us who would survive would face the enemy, because he would come in behind his own barrage. The old tactics, which in fact he did. And we managed to cut through the wire on the north area at several places. And as the barrage lifted, we began to wend our way through the wire with, in good order, fighting a rearguard action. As you'll know, when you fight a rearguard action like that on the retreat, you have your line of infantrymen who hold up the enemy. And when they've held them up for a certain time, they fall back behind another line, behind them. And they hold the enemy until they fall back. And you hope that you've broken the enemy's attacking onslaught by so doing, but paying the penalty and leaving men behind you, your own men. It was now the heavy shelling had passed over us, and now it was mortars, automatic, rifle, everything you can think of. And they came in with a bayonet. We fought them back. I was now with my wounded, those that I could get together. Some of them were blind, tied together, tied by means of long tapes, bandages, so they could stumble along. We managed to get out those that we could, those that we couldn't, left behind. Tried to get mules out. The enemy hadn't made the progress that he had hoped. We were giving him an awful mauling, a very spirited mauling, which he hadn't expected. We filtered back through the wire. I was with the hand guard trying to get my wounded through. We had to climb a mound which is well over 1,000 feet, rocky. Full view of the enemy. And somehow we managed to jink up this, taking any cover we could find. Got to the top and looked over at the ready. The enemy hadn't followed us up. There was only one possible explanation. He'd had such a mauling, they weren't prepared to come on. Four days, I'm told, nobody really remembers, of nightmare, day and night, dragging along through the mud, heavy rain, very little rations, very little medical supply, fewer mules than we had previously. And we knew that our nearest troops were north on a lake called the Ndogi Lake. Ndogi. And smell of death everywhere. We held together. We slept on top of each other, trying to remain warm. And we did get to the place where the Gurkha platoon was. And one of our parties, with three parties with us, they were not in the block. Well, one of them was in the block, yes, the Presbyterian party, but the Presbyterian, Roman Catholic, and Church of England. One of the parties, I remember so well, he was there receiving those who could stumble up to him, trying to address their wounds and trying to comfort them. And we got ourselves into some sort of shape and managed to transport the wounded and seriously ill up to the Ndogi Lake, where the Royal Air Force very gallantly brought in a flying boat to an uncharted lake. That was the most courageous thing to do. Flying boat is so vulnerable to anything in the waters, you know. And they made sufficient journeys to get the wounded and sick out. And other units began to close in on us, our own units, to form some sort of defensive perimeter. We could hardly stand up, and we were told that the army headquarters, under the commander whom I mentioned previously, designated us to take Hill 2171 from the enemy. We couldn't believe it. We got ourselves together, a supply drop, which is a godsend, of medical equipment. We proceeded to the area which had to be taken from the Japanese, quite an appreciable precipitous hill, very adequately entrenched. A detachment of the 9th Gurkhas was detailed to take the ridge under the command of an excellent young captain, Jim Blaker. And they crawled up the hill in the face of direct fire from the enemy, and the attack was wavering. In fact, it was becoming beaten back, and young Blaker came out with his gun firing from the hip straight at the enemy and said, "Come on, Joanne, come on," and his Bersko Kali, and they came up behind him with a tremendous rush. He dropped, riddled with bullets, and the hill was taken. He was awarded the posthumous Victoria Cross.
How much did you receive it yourself?
I was behind this, but I saw what was happening. This was witnessed by several of us who were up front.
What were you expected to do yourself in the attack?
Well, I was following up in order to deal with the casualties. It was that sort of mobile warfare. You were going forward the whole time, and the hill was taken. Thereafter, we really were finished, and we were flown out, back to Calcutta.
You haven't said anything so far about the Indian National Army. Did you come across...
The INA. We got evidence of this. If you go back sometime to Sapong, the Caledon Valley, undoubtedly at least one, if not two, of the people on our side crossed over and joined up with the enemy. We had evidence of this, and they were INA. At least we assumed they must be. The evidence pointed that way. That was the only direct contact that I had with this particular organization. But one heard about it particularly among the prisoners of war. They didn't stand up to the enemy.
What did you personally think of the Japanese enemy during the actual fighting?
I think we misunderestimated the Japanese. Our intelligence at the start was not sufficient to tell us just what we were facing. It's many years ago now, of course, but in those days, the average Japanese in the ranks worshipped his emperor, and I mean worshipped. He was God. This is no longer so today, we know. So it's difficult to accept this as being true, but in fact it was true. And when they went into action, they wished to die in the service of the emperor. That was their way to paradise.
Did you have any respect for them?
Their tremendous endurance, their utter disregard of personal danger, their devious tactics in its best sense, militarily, yes. one could not but help but admire them. They really were, in the early days, an invincible force. Until we had learnt battlecraft, junglecraft, and realized that we were the superior. And of course, ultimately, we came out much on top with our infrastructure, armament, movement, and intelligence. Intelligence, I mean, in the army sense.
But at the time, did you feel any hatred for them?
The feeling that one has as a soldier when you're fighting an enemy who is ruthless. And I'm sorry to have to bring this up, but you've asked me obliquely. They were utterly ruthless and utterly without compassion, inflicting injury where beyond the point that was necessary in warfare. What would you think if you found a friend of yours pinioned against a teak tree with a bayonet through the wrist of both the left and the right arm and the lower part of the legs missing because they've been suspended just off the ground where the hungry jackal could get at them? That, of course, was done with a view to making us so terrified that we wouldn't wish to continue fighting. I don't have to tell you it had precisely the opposite effect. And this is the sort of thing that breeds hatred and cruelty in war.
But are you sure?
If an act like this is committed, the side against which is committed are bound to react unfavorably.
But are you sure that things like this really did happen?
Yes, it did. I can assure you of that.
But it made the Chindits only more determined to fight?
We were determined to see the end of this. In those days, I suppose we were a little bit out of touch with reality in that we believed that what we were going through was necessary in order to remove this unpleasant influence from civilization, to, if you like, to ensure that we were part of the necessary unit which was going to bring a more humane feeling into civilization. Not that war is civilized, but nevertheless, even war can be fought without the severe cruelty that we witnessed. And I think we really believed that this is what we were going to achieve at the time.
But this crucifixion of the Chindit, did that just happen once or more than once?
I understand that it wasn't a solo event.
One thing I don't think that we've mentioned about medical problems in the jungle is what about if somebody broke a bone?
Yes, well, the most serious thing, of course, is a fractured skull. Fractured skulls, if you don't rest them, they do badly. And then naturally, they couldn't be rested. They were on the back of the bamboo stretcher being trailed over the most unpleasant areas, up and down, over the rocks and so on, in the hot sun, without adequate nursing. They did badly. Limbs, the upper limb especially, was not so serious. You could do something with it. And if there was an open wound, of course, that was dangerous because of sepsis. And in those circumstances, the young doctor was taught, excise all the damaged tissue. It must be removed immediately. But don't sew up the wound. The wounds had to be left open. The most dangerous thing you can do with a warm wound under those conditions is to sew it up, suture it. It must be left open. What is called technically delayed primary suture. Chest did badly, especially if it's a collapsed lung, as you can imagine. The trauma and the difficulty. Lower limb, of course, was serious in that the man was immobilized, especially a pelvis. They did badly. Joints as such you could deal with, particularly if there wasn't too much soft tissue injury, even a very large joint. You could hope to get them out by, if necessary, having them behind the mule. If sepsis got into a joint, of course, very serious.
Did you get soldiers with renal problems much in the jungle?
Stones in the kidney. Not commonly, because they're all young, they're all very active, physically active, and although we were always short of liquid, that wasn't a common presentation, no. There was no real problems there. And one of the things which is always stressed when I'm giving a lecture, somebody will stand up and say, what about the young soldier who's misbehaved and has picked up something he shouldn't have, he had an daughter? And I'd say there wasn't a single case of that from start to finish for obvious reasons.
Is that true?
Quite true. You never saw women, you see.
What about the villagers?
There were no women. Pardon?
The villagers?
We never went near a village. We avoided them. So that, I didn't see a single case of venereal disease.
You were telling me earlier on about the two chaps from the aircrew who were buried in the jungle, but you haven't told me about the fate of the man who stayed with you.
Yes, well, it is the pilot who stayed with us. He wasn't killed. The two individuals who were killed were both casualties that we were flying out. They were wounded casualties. They were our own troops. They were killed in the crash. He was thrown into the upper part of the tree, and that saved him. He stayed with us for 3 days and three nights, a very gallant fellow. He from Georgia. And he used to say every so often, say, Doc, I'd rather be up there than down here. And when it came to the time when we were able to fly him out in a light plane, he turned to me and he gave me his gully knife, which was a wonderful thing, a sort of knives and forks and spoons on it. And I felt that this was a very generous gift. I didn't like to tell him that it's very unlikely we'd be able to keep it very long, burdened on as we were on the weight side. But I felt I had to say, so I said, well, Sergeant, we are comrades in arms, and all I can do is, we're never going to meet again. All I can say is, Godspeed, and thank you. And he turned to me and he said, say, Doc, I'm giving you this knife. It's very special to me. But I do it for one good reason. And I said, what is that? He said, I think you're being treated stinking. All I could murmur was, thank you.
Were any of the Chindits who came out of the jungle fit for active service after their experience?
The figure quoted to me, those of us who came out, over 80% were unfit for further active service. That's the figure which I think can be accepted.
What psychological state were you personally in after the jungle? Were you having nightmares about it?
No, dead weary. Physically weary, several stone underweight, of course, but determined to see it through, and I stayed to the end. I came out late, as did the Brigadier John Masters.
What happened to you in the rest of the war?
Well, after we came out, starting there, we realized that by virtue of the fact what we had done at the Blackpool Block, we had held up reinforcements for a period of some 6 weeks. We like to feel that we had a very useful part to play in holding Kohima. And I always think on these occasions of the Greek put together, the words are put together for one of the Greek battles. When you go home, tell them of us and say, for your tomorrow, we gave our today. After that, I had a period of leave, went up to Kashmir, and then on to the northwest frontier, where I commanded a field ambulance, and I was asked to volunteer for the parachute division, which was being formed at that time. In fact, it had been formed, but was expanding, and I accepted that, did my parachute jumps at Choklala, and gained the parachute wings, which was necessary before joining the division. We trained very hard after that. The war finished. We weren't brought into action. Following that, I got married in India and was in the service for quite a long time afterwards, but I managed to specialize and had the privilege of sitting higher qualifications at, in fact, different Royal Colleges, one of which is in Ireland, you'll be glad to know, two in Scotland and two in England, and was accepted in as a member originally, but that you always hope will be, in my case it was, you go a step further. And this was, I suppose, satisfaction in that I'd managed to get back to real clinical medicine again, working with the patient, which I've done now since I became a consultant.